From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Businesses all across the state have succumbed to the pressures of the pandemic, with devastating consequences for workers and our economy. Today, one man who closed his businesses talks about why those who were sidelined still need our help.
We need to get people back to work so that our communities can be healthy and thrive again.
Also, a longer-term perspective on the seismic changes shaping the state's business ecology.
I talked to so many small business owners who really miss having connections with their customers in a human way. That's part of why they got into what they're doing.
And today we meet a biologist who's collaborating with a colleague across 143 years. An experiment begun in 1879 is bearing fruit in East Lansing.
Why is it that these seeds remain viable in the soil for so long and don't germinate?
We'll hear what it tells us about seeds, especially those from native plants. Those stories and more coming up. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, the 143-year experiment. Plant biologists with Michigan State University continue to explore questions set into motion by a 19th century colleague.
He mixed up 50 seeds of each species into these bottles and buried them here on campus. Basically, every 5 years, he would extract a bottle, shake out its contents, and put it in a greenhouse and see what would germinate.
That's coming up later in the show. But first, it's never easy to start your own business. It's even tougher to keep it open. During the COVID-19 pandemic, a prolonged crisis that's like nothing we've seen in our lifetimes, small business owners are facing incredible and sometimes insurmountable challenges without a clear end in sight. This has forced many to make tough decisions to close their doors permanently. What's the best way to help people get their small business through such a unique and extended crisis? We're turning now to two people who've had eyes on what business owners are experiencing over this past year and the role that it plays in all of our lives. David Lin is the former CEO of the regional coffee chain Espresso Royale, also former owner of Bubble Island, a bubble tea shop in Ann Arbor, two businesses that were forced to close amid the pandemic. He started a new crowdfunding philanthropy project called the COVID Rescue Fund, aimed at helping fellow business owners who are struggling right now. Dave Lin, welcome to Stateside.
Thanks for having me.
And Jeffrey Sanchez-Burks is here with us, too. He's a behavioral scientist and a professor of business administration at the University of Michigan's Ross School of Business. He's also faculty director of the Impact Studio, which uses design thinking and process in the service of social impact. Jeffrey, it's good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me on.
Dave Lin, I wanted to start with you. You had to make the really heartbreaking choice to close down your businesses as a result of the COVID pandemic. Can I just ask, how are you doing?
Well, you know, I'm doing the best I can. I think that it took me a while to kind of, you know, get over it. You know, you mentioned, you know, those two businesses, Espresso Royale and Bubble Island. Both of those things I had been operating for a long time, the bubble tea shop for 20 years. And when I shut that down, around 300 people lost their jobs. And a lot of them were veteran employees that had been there for decades. And so it really took a toll. I would say that I was emotionally bankrupt for a while. But then after a while, I realized that, hey, you know, if I took my venture capital background, I have a chance to combine all this together to turn my negative experience to make a positive difference in this world.
300 people. Does that include your hourly workers? And who else would be included in that number?
The 300 people, so, you know, a lot of part-time workers, but within that number, there are people that are long-time store managers, long-time coffee roasters, you know, long-time assistant managers, you know, people that are putting their hearts into the business to make it successful. They just love it. And so it was talking to those people that made it particularly difficult. They were all great about it. They understood, but it's still hard to tell someone, hey, you know, you just spent the last 20 years making this place as great as it could be. You've put your heart and soul into it as much as everyone else, and the business is going away. You're losing your job, and we can't pay severance. I'm sorry, because the business is gone.
Was there a point with either business? I don't know if it happened both at the same time, but was there a point at which you knew you were going to have to do this?
It happened so fast, April. Like, it was kind of a no-brainer decision. The bubble tea shop in Bubble Island that I've had forever, usually would do something like $3,000 a day during this time period. And the last week that we were open, it was doing $30 a day. So it's like, how long can you sustain that with or without any government programs that were going to come out? And the answer for me was, it's just too much. You know, like doing that for a month might be okay. 2 months would be pushing it. So it was an easy decision, but a hard thing to do.
Jeffrey Sanchez-Burks, I wanted to ask you a question. If a business owner is fortunate and forward-thinking, she or he will have some kind of plan for the worst-case scenarios that life throws to us, a fire, a flood, a blizzard, some sort of major power outage or, an earthquake. Maybe there's even a succession plan. But I can't think of anybody I've run across who was thinking about how to keep operating during a pandemic. How do you see COVID confounding our conventional wisdom about what keeps businesses and their place in our livelihood alive?
Yeah, it's interesting. You can think of it as similar to a natural disaster, an earthquake or whatnot. The challenge, of course, is those are punctuated moments where maybe there's some warning, but when it's over, there's the recovery. And I think what you're seeing, what you're hearing is there's so much uncertainty about when will it end and what will that look like. In some ways, it's like this paper that's been crumpled up for a year and it's still being unfolded and we're still learning where these creases, where these wrinkles are. And so it's not just impossible to have planned for this. It's an evolving dynamic. It's an evolving landscape. And so there's a lot of emotional complexity that goes with that. It's not that you can just begin emotionally and financially recovering. It's still a journey. It's a unique experience compared to many other disasters.
I mean, can you think of any other reference points in which this country's ecosystem has been challenged in this way, this sort of slow motion car wreck?
Well, I think about, the last pandemic, and which came on the heels of a world war, and also about the Depression. There are people who never changed, who never recovered, so to speak. If you have grandparents that grew up in the Depression, they'll pick up pennies and sew their socks. There are people who come back from war who never change. And what we're seeing is it's, again, not as if this hurricane went by and now we can rebuild and just go back to normal. There's a lot of variation in individuals and business experience about what has happened and what is happening. And there are some imprints of this that will last forever. And for others, it will be a thing in the past. And I think that's really important, is to remember there's a lot of emotional complexity out there. And unlike in the past, when norms of professionalism can say, well, your emotions are something that's inappropriate in the workplace, it's that there's just a lot of complexity out there that we're going to need to acknowledge and navigate together.
This is such an interesting question about how all of our habits will change, and sometimes permanently, during this time. Dave Lynn, your business has relied on a couple of different things. Certainly caffeine addiction, or I guess bubble tea affinity. But also, to a great degree, just people's daily habits. You know, I'm walking this way, I'm going to stop in, I'm going to grab a coffee. And also the momentary serendipity of seeing a place that looks welcoming and, oh, they've got something I like, and just stopping in, the momentary decisions to buy something. And it just feels like the habits and the momentary decisions have been completely wiped out by what we're all going through right now in many areas of Michigan. Dave, did you hear from customers who wanted to visit but couldn't, or just were afraid to be in stores anywhere?
Absolutely. So we experienced every color of the rainbow you can imagine. You know, you had people that were saying things like, oh, we can't wait for you guys to be open again, or, you know, what, you know, we want to come and see you, we miss you guys. And then you have the flip side of people saying, why are you bothering? This is all a joke. You know, COVID isn't real. People are overreacting, and like people getting angry at us for trying to take precautions. So you really kind of experience all of that. And in a volume business, like a coffee shop or bubble tea shop, you know, you're going through, you know, 400 or 500 tickets a day. And if you lose, you know, 10%, 20%, that's a disaster. Here we're losing, you know, 70%, 80%. So it was much worse.
Jeffrey Sanchez-Burks, it feels like we've been there. There's been this time when we all feel like we've been treading water in a number of different ways. Just a few more months. Just a few more months till we get to the vaccine. Just a few more months until I get my dose of the vaccine, and then we'll be, quote unquote, sing it with me, back to normal. At what point do we as consumers, or do we as business owners, or do we as workers have to say, this is the normal right now?
One of the things that was frustrating early on was the use of this expression, social distancing, when in reality, people meant physical distancing. During disasters, during uncertainty, there is a natural human yearning for connection and bonding. And you're seeing this a lot. And I think I loved your question about the serendipity of tea shops or coffee shops. People are yearning for these social connections. And so if you're an organization in which you're trying to make the most of when people come into the office, there needs to be a focus on creating what could be called immensely human interactions or immensely human moments, where work that can be done asynchronously, fine, let that be done asynchronously, but how can we foster these moments when people can come together, share their stories, see each other's smiles, you know, as you're seeing businesses in you know, context where it is perfectly legal and safe for fully vaccinated people not to wear masks, to be able to see with greater fidelity other human beings in 3D and have those connections. So it's a really important opportunity not to just go back to putting people in cubicles. There's a wonderful opportunity to maybe create a more immensely human form of work. And again, in the important role of coffee shops and tea shops, especially on a college campus, can't wait to have more and more of those moments, because that's when you do get to have these random conversations or meet with friends and or simply work in the context of other human beings.
We need to take a quick break here. In just a moment, I'll continue my conversation with David Lin and Jeffrey Sanchez-Burks about how COVID may have permanently changed the way that businesses and their customers operate. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. My guests today are Dave Lin, the CEO of the coffee chain Espresso Royale and the former owner of Bubble Island, a bubble tea shop. He had to shut down his businesses during the course of the pandemic, and he started a new fundraising effort that's aimed at helping other small businesses who are struggling. And we're also talking today with Jeffrey Sanchez-Burks of Michigan Ross School of Business, faculty director of the Impact Studio, about some of the sociological impacts that we're all experiencing as workers, as employers, and as customers in this moment. Dave Lin, early on in the pandemic, there was this thought, well, of course, you know, the government can do something for businesses. The CARES Act was passed to try to help small businesses pull through. Were those interventions of much help from your perspective?
I actually think the government has done a huge amount of good work for small businesses. You mentioned the CARES Act and the PPP loan. There's the EIDL loans, and there's now the Restaurant Revitalization Funds, which recently launched. I think those are fantastic and have helped so many people stay alive. The unfortunate truth, or the reality, is that these are one-size-fits-all solutions. And in reality, nothing fits all. There is no one-size-fits-all. So what's happening is you have a lot of people that are falling through the cracks that have a lot to offer our communities, but they're, for whatever reason, they are ineligible to use any of these programs.
Yeah. I know that there are businesses in Michigan who have been able to ride it out, and there are even restaurant and retail spaces that have been doing pretty good business lately, depending on what their local situation is and what their workforce situation is. But it does feel like we have most of the state's businesses on a kind of extended starvation diet. There's still a lot of sectors that have lost employees during this time. Dave, what is your observation of what this has been like for business owners? And, you know, based on your own experience and people that you've been talking to.
So I think generally speaking, all of the applicants at the COVID Rescue Fund that I've been talking to, we are all reacting to this impression that the general population feels like COVID is in the past. And for people that have not experienced hardship, they don't understand that there's a whole generation of small business owners that are struggling and desperate. And I'm not talking about the typical stories that are in the news, like the restaurateur or the coffee shop owner. No, I'm actually talking about people like a yoga studio owner who's focused on teaching people how to be healthy and how to be physically fit. And that person's been doing it for decades. That person, what's next for them? They might be working at McDonald's. You know, I'm talking about, I recently had an applicant. He's a Taekwondo instructor. He's trained Olympians. He's trained U.S. national champions. He spent his whole life doing that. Where is he supposed to go next? What does his resume say? You know, where is he going to do? You know, like, what is he going to do? And so, like, I think generally speaking, my impression is that, this generation of small businesses is being swept under the rug and ignored. And it is impossible to understand what the ripple effects of losing these small businesses are going to have on our communities. And I think this misuse of talent is a huge tragedy that we all need to wake up to. I think we need to get these people back to work so that our communities can be healthy and thrive again.
Yeah. Dave Lynn, the COVID Rescue Fund that you started, I wanted to ask you a bit more about that. This is a volunteer-operated project, and it's aiming to help small businesses in Michigan, but also in other parts of the country that are struggling. How did you get this idea that your next thing was going to be helping the other businesses that were under the gun?
That's a great question. You know, like I said earlier, you know, it took me a long time to digest what had happened to me personally when COVID came and those businesses closed. And I think that I felt generally a bit of a frustration and a little desperation in some ways, because I could see, you know, the CARES Act and the PPP. I could walk down the street or drive down the street and see that other businesses were doing okay. And I just felt like if you are a business owner that has lost your business, it is clear that you are being ignored, that the other businesses around you are being triaged because the need is so great. And so it just kind of got my mind thinking, hey, you know, is there a technology-based solution that could help fix this? And luckily, there is, you know, people already doing crowdfunding with great success. You know, all the GoFundMes that you've heard about in the news. Charity Water was a huge inspiration for me to see what those guys have done. And the Barstool Fund also, which launched over New Year's, has done a fantastic job in providing resources for small businesses. So, you know, I kind of just like connected the dots and thought, my experience can lead the solution for these small business owners that have been impacted like me. And so that's kind of what led me here.
How do you decide who gets the funding?
Great question. So on our website, if you go and you look, there is a voting element, right? The voting element is there to help us gauge the community support that the various applicants have. So if people have more votes, that means that they've directed more people to the site that have voted, which is a huge ask for anyone. You know, stop your day, go to this website and vote for me. So that's one way that we gauge community support. We're also going through their experience financially, and we've required them to give us some financial metrics to give us an idea of how successful they have been in the past. So the combination of those two things kind of guides the decision making.
Dave, we've all experienced losses of businesses in our community, in some cases businesses that meant a whole lot. But what about the idea that there are extinction events, or that there are just changing market conditions, and that these business owners who we know and who've become part of our lives are probably going to figure something out once we get out from under all this? Why are the grants important right now?
Well, they're really important because many of these people have been hit so hard from COVID that they actually don't have the opportunity to come back and do something new. You know, the one common theme that keeps coming up with every interview I have is a theme of, I paid my employees out of my savings because I wanted to take care of them. So as COVID is going month after month after month, these business owners are being bled dry because they're trying to take care of the people around them. When they're forced to close, they are financially and emotionally bankrupt. And when you are in that position with your credit cards maxed out, you have no equity in your home because you took your home, all the equity out, it makes it more difficult to get funding from anybody. And I also think that in our climate, with all the stimulus money, all the free money that's being printed, there are protections in place to detect fraud. And a lot of times these business owners are being flagged because their personal balance sheets are so terrible. So they really are, many of these people are on the verge of sinking into poverty. And I think that, again, is a huge misuse of talent. And I think they have a lot more to offer our world and our communities.
If you're just joining us, we're talking today about what's going on with small businesses as they adjust to pandemic change and how we as consumers, workers, and employers are changing too. My guests are David Lin of the COVID Rescue Fund and Jeffrey Sanchez-Burks of Michigan Ross School of Business. Jeffrey, you've written and talked a lot about the things that businesses need in addition to money to make it through this time. You've talked about that emotional acknowledgement that is important. What are some of the systems of support that you think are getting people through to the extent that people are getting through this right now?
You know, there's some very innovative, some very low-tech, innovative ways people are coming together. So you are seeing wonderful cooperation among previously, you know, competing small businesses. We've seen some sort of the emergence of what you could call like a flash huddle or a flash mob, where with a little bit of organizations, you get small business owners together to share stories about what's working, what's not working, like in the early days. How do you get these styrofoam or paper things for takeout? And where do you find these supplies? And what are you doing for this or that? Just because there is so much inefficiency, not only in resource allocation, like Dave's talking about, but also just information asymmetries. People will find out this, but they don't have their normal get-togethers to be able to share information. And a lot of small business owners aren't part of these large chambers of commerce where there's a lot of information that is centralized and disseminated. And so part of that gathering is not just for social emotional support, but also just for information sharing. So there is a need for more of like what Dave's doing in terms of being very entrepreneurial and thinking what areas are not being addressed, what businesses aren't being taken care of. And putting aside those that, you know, there's attrition and extinction moments, as you mentioned, where are there sort of lost opportunities? It's not that necessarily every business will return as it was, but I loved Dave's earlier point about we don't want mismatches in talents. How can we make optimal use? How can we help people really leverage their strengths? And so, you know, disasters are sort of a hotbed for innovation. And I think it's really important to foster and support a lot of innovative thinking about how we can be more resilient, right? From population ecology, the notion of resiliency isn't that you always stay strong, it's that you can bounce back as an ecosystem. And if you think about our community and the business community, it's not that each thing returns as it was, but collectively, we're able to build back. And as a participant in the 1994 earthquake in Southern California, you don't just build back, but you try to build back better.
Right. Jeffrey, I've heard people say anecdotally that their workplaces right now just feel so wound up. Everyone is under piles of stress at home, dealing with kids, maybe caring for relatives or friends who have fallen sick with COVID and just trying to keep their economic lives going. And there are pressures within how we're working right now and everybody being on soul-killing Zoom meetings all the time or having to, you know, sort of think through all the physical distancing in their workplaces if they are back in person. And tempers flare over stuff that normally would get worked out pretty quickly if we were all right beside each other. Do you think that there will be some changes coming out of this in the way we talk about conflicts at work or the way people manage conflict or their own situations?
Yeah. Well, for example, we're finding that this old strategy of, you know, how are you doing? Or everyone say, let's share a piece of good news, isn't working. This idea that everyone should have a positive moment or that things are simple aren't working. Instead, we're finding that organizations are finding more traction when they acknowledge the emotional complexity in people's lives. And so a very simple version of this is rather than ask people how they're doing or ask for a positive piece of news, they say, everyone share two different emotions that they're feeling. And people are like, wow, you're only asking for two. I could put so many more. But already in two different emotions, we're now getting to that complexity. And you're doing a number of things. One is you're helping legitimize what is going on in people's lives. And it's authentic because you're not trying to just mold everyone into the same area. And we are redefining notions of professionalism, which have, you know, put very strict boundaries between work and non-work. And it's very difficult to do it. If I don't hear somebody's baby or dog or something going on in the background, I think they're, what do the kids say? Like they're fronting. It's like there's clearly reality going on in people's lives. And so we might emerge from this with a much more authentic human way of defining professionalism.
Yeah. If we think back to the early months of the pandemic, I remember there being a lot of ink spilled over the way that employers were having to get real about, you know, these emotional acknowledgments and, you know, telling people, go take some time with your kids today if you need to. And then many businesses seem to have experienced what I think of as urgency creep. Deadlines are deadlines. And as people like Dave Lynn can easily tell you, there are lease payments to be made and there are employees whose paychecks need to cash on time. And maybe the staffing cutbacks have shifted a lot more responsibility onto the plates of those who remain employed. Do you think that there are ways for us to push back against the pace that we're in right now? And Dave, I wonder, let's hear from Jeffrey first. But Dave, I wonder if you have some thoughts on that, too.
It is interesting. Survey after survey, and this is global trends, are showing that the vast majority of people don't want to return full time to the office. They say they're productive, but they also report that they're miserable. And so it's not even clear what it is that would help people. From high school here all the way to the undergrads, there was a big request to have in-person class. And then each day, fewer people would actually be in class. They said, well, that's not exactly what I had hoped for. And so I think we need to have some spirit of experimenting, an iterative approach to this redefining of what the new world will look like, because we're not going to get it right and it will change.
Hey, Dave Lynn, I know that there are certain things that we can push back on and say, let's just slow it down. And there are certain realities of running a business. Do you think there are ways in which those things might change?
Well, I think like it's from a small business perspective, I'd say that the changes that you guys are talking about, to me, I just see a lot of uncertainty. Like if from a small business perspective, when you are relying on volume to so that you can pay your bills, it just highlights to me that the post-pandemic world for certain businesses is going to be incredibly challenging. You know, imagine if you are a downtown restaurant or downtown retail spot that relies on office workers being around for lunch, and that's where you do all your volume. Those office workers are not there because of all of the reconfiguration that Jeffrey's talking about. You know, like, what do you do? You know, you have to do other things. And there are, you know, numerous examples of how the post-pandemic world is going to be different. And small business owners, you know, generally speaking, don't have a cushion to iterate a lot. You know, you kind of have to get it right in the first few times, or you don't have money to pivot. So I think it's going to be very challenging for small businesses moving forward.
Dave Lynn, he was formerly the CEO of the coffee chain Espresso Royale in Southeast Michigan and the owner of Bubble Island, the bubble tea shop, and he's now running the COVID Rescue Fund. We've also been talking with Jeffrey Sanchez Burks, a behavioral scientist and a professor at Michigan Ross School of Business. Dave, Jeffrey, it's been a real pleasure talking to you, and thanks for taking a few minutes with us for, I guess, that emotional acknowledgement.
Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, thanks.
Businesses and our workplaces are one arena where we come together, but they're not the only places. You might have heard that Governor Whitmer has announced the state is loosening the restrictions on social gatherings for up to 100 people for those who've been vaccinated. Some of us cannot wait for this to happen. For others, it could be an adjustment. Do you even remember how to interact with humans at the backyard barbecue? We'll tackle that question later in the week. In a moment, what MSU scientists are finding out about the longevity of seeds.
Why is it that these seeds remain viable in the soil for so long, you know, and don't germinate? And what are the triggers?
That's after the break. We'll be right back. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. The longest ongoing scientific experiment in the United States has been taking place right here in Michigan. In 1879, a botanist named William Beale wondered how long seeds could remain viable underground. So he buried 20 unsealed bottles of seeds to be dug up after some amount of years had elapsed. He knew full well that the answer to his experiment might not come in his lifetime. The botanist leading Beale's seed experiment today is Professor Frank Teluski, professor of plant biology at Michigan State University, and he's with us now. Frank, welcome to Stateside.
Well, thank you very much.
Tell us a little bit about William Beale.
Well, Professor Beale was born in Michigan. His parents moved to Michigan from upstate New York, and he was born down in the Adrian area, out in the farm country. His parents, of course, were farmers, and he had a great passion for plants coming up from that background. And so he went on to school and on to college. He eventually went on to Harvard University, where he studied under Professor Asa Gray, who's a very well-known botanist, and earned his degree and was exposed to botanical gardens and other interesting plant issues that were being addressed at Harvard at the time. And he eventually and came to Michigan State in 1870. And he founded the Beale Botanical Gardens here on campus in 1873, of which I'm the director. And he also established this experiment, as you described, in 1879. He did a lot of work with farmers in the Farmer Institute. Michigan State University is the oldest land-grant institution in the country, established land-grant institution. And he would do a lot of work going out and talking to farmers, the Farmers Institute, and you know, giving them advice and listening to their questions and trying to help them answer their questions to increase productivity on the land they were farming.
Tell us a little more about what he was trying to find out. Why was the viability of seeds over time something of interest to him, and I guess also to farmers that he would have been friends with?
Well, it was a very interesting question because at this point in time with agriculture and other aspects of growing plants, he was becoming more increasingly aware of the what we refer to today as the seed bank, and that is the seeds that are stored in the soil that will remain dormant for an unknown period of time. And when you disturb that soil and you bring that soil up through cultivation, or if there's a disturbance in the habitat, a fire or a flood, these could help expose the buried seeds, and those seeds would begin to germinate and repopulate the area. And so I could see farmers asking Professor Beale back then, so, you know, we're out here cultivating these fields. We have to do a lot of our work by hand. We're weeding. We have a hoe. We're going through and hoeing our rows. A long row to hoe, as the saying goes, means you got a lot of work ahead of you.
Right.
And, you know, when are these seeds going to stop appearing? Because we keep getting them before they, you know, they produce new seeds. And so I can see that being part of the reason why Professor Beale thought this would be an interesting question to address.
So, like I said, he had this idea to bury bottles of seeds. Can you explain a little bit more about how he set this up? What did he have in mind for how often he'd go back and check on them?
Sure. So you did pretty good describing that at the top of the story. But he had 20 bottles, and he had 21 species of seeds that he was interested in, of plants he selected. A lot of them were annual or biannual weeds. Some of them were not so weedy. And he mixed up 50 seeds of each species into these bottles and buried them here on campus. And basically, every 5 years, he would extract a bottle and shake out its contents and put it in a greenhouse and see what would germinate. He continued that work on until his retirement in 1910, and he passed the experiment on to Professor Darlington. And Professor Darlington, who came to replace Professor Beale here at MSU, continued the experiment on till 1920. In 1920, Professor Darlington made the decision to extend the period to every 10 years because pretty much he was seeing the same results that had happened over the course of the past several five-year periods. And that continued on until 1980. In 1980, Professor Bandersky and Kivalon had taken over this study, and that was the 100th anniversary, the 100th year bottle. And so it was put to a vote by the Department of Plant Biology, then known as the Department of Botany and Plant Pathology, and whether or not they should extend the period to every 20 years. So I arrived here at Michigan State in 1993, and in 1999, Professor Jan Zeevaart, who had received the information and the map, location map from Professor Bandersky, had asked me as the director of the Botanical Garden, named for Professor Beale, and being a plant physiologist, if I would be interested in taking it on for the next generation. And so I was very honored that Jan asked me that. And so here I am today. So this is my second bottle.
So tell me about the digging. What do you remember about the first time you went out to dig them up?
Oh, gosh, I remember we agreed to meet early in the morning, as has been done for the history of the experiment. And by the time I had gotten out to the location where the bottles are, Jan had already excavated the hole and had neatly exposed the bottle tops there. And lo and behold, said, well, you have the honor, go down and, extract the bottle. And so I did. And then we took it back to the laboratory. And for the past several experiments on this, the bottles have been emptied out and the seeds placed inside of a growth chamber to give us a little bit better control than you get in a greenhouse in terms of environmental conditions for germination. So we met down in the basement of the plant biology department where the growth chambers are, and we extracted the seeds and the sandy soil mix that the seeds are mixed into and spread it out and waited to see what would happen.
Is it hard to locate the place where you left the jars? I mean, I don't know if GPS is of any help to you these days, but how do you find them again?
Well, for over 100 years, nobody relied on GPS, so I think we could be able to find it without GPS today. No, we didn't use a GPS. There is a map. The map was redrawn. The map that I have was redrawn in 1989. So it's a very nicely drafted map by a professional draftsperson, one of our landscape architects I talked to about it. She recalls that she may have actually been the person that drafted that back then. So it's got, details in terms of, where it is on campus and landmarks and how to find the bottles.
I think you said a moment ago that the seeds are traditionally dug up very early in the morning. Why is that?
Yeah. Well, for two reasons. First of all, it's been hypothesized that light is a trigger for germination, and some seeds do require light. So lettuce seeds, for example, when you sow them in your garden or in your greenhouse for planting in your vegetable garden, require light to germinate. So we want to make sure that we don't get any sunlight or ambient light shining on the bottles and accidentally, stimulate germination of seeds that would still be underground. So it's a precaution. And the other aspect of it is that we just don't also want to have a lot of distraction and a lot of attention drawn to the dig. And so we dig it up, and when there's nobody on campus and nobody wandering around, and we just kind of try to keep it as buried as possible.
Frank, why is it that the seeds don't germinate when they're buried for so many years? Is it only the matter of the light?
Well, no, and this is actually, I think, becoming a very interesting question. By diversifying my team for the seed study, it used to just be passed along from one researcher to another. This year, I actually included four other researchers onto the team. So with these four additional faculty members who joined us, it's really an exciting time to discuss questions and pose hypotheses that we can test and look at this from a 21st century perspective. You've got this experiment started in the last quarter of the 19th century, and here we are in the first quarter of the 20th century, and techniques and technologies have changed dramatically. DNA sequencing is readily available. DNA was only really discovered as the carrier of the genetic code back in the 1950s, so Professor Beale had no idea. And so how can we use some of these new technologies that we have access to answer some of the questions that are being raised? Exactly like you were saying before, why is it that these seeds remain viable in the soil for so long, and don't germinate? And what are the triggers? And so We're looking at some of those questions. Some of those questions have been addressed by others in other studies. But again, it seems to be a cycling of temperature and of moisture availability. The soil that we excavated is moist, but it's not wet. We don't know what kind of condition the seeds are in terms of imbibition of water, the absorption of water by the seed. But they're also buried down in the ground, not very deep, so they're not unreasonably deep. They're not below the frost line, so they definitely go through a seasonal cycle, but they don't go through a diurnal cycle like they would up at the surface. And with sunshine shining on the soil, it can actually raise the soil temperature up quite significantly over ambient air temperature, and then at night really cool down. So some of these cyclings appear to be involved in the germination process that does not happen when they're buried deeper in the soil and kind of insulated, buffered from those environmental extremes.
Huh. Is it too soon to say what you found out about this question of whether native or invasive seeds, have an edge in germination?
No, because we haven't really looked at that. And the experimental design that Professor Beal established does not really give us the opportunity to answer that question. But as a team, we've been discussing the possibility of setting up a Beal 2.0 seed experiment where we would actually design the experiment specifically to address some of these questions.
Yeah. These things that you're finding out about viability must mean something for ecological conservationists. Would you say that the experiment so far has influenced that area of ecology?
I believe so. A number of people who are working in the area of seed germination do cite the papers that have been published by the various scientists, myself and Jan included, our paper in 2002. And I think it's very important from that aspect because this is an actual controlled, as best as we can control it, experiment in terms of its design. There are a lot of reports of seeds germinating that were buried in the permafrost up in the Arctic region about seeds that were maybe buried or found in excavations, archaeological excavations in caves, or even in latrines. It's amazing, some excavations in latrines
wow.
have actually found seeds germinating after being buried for over 100 years. So the fact that seeds have long viability is pretty well established. That's not the question. But this one actually mimics or replicates the natural conditions you would find within the seed bank as it occurs in nature. And so specifically, these bottles are filled with a sandy mix, which the sandy soil is what surrounds the bottles. And they're left open at the base so that there's gas exchange. Oxygen and carbon dioxide can diffuse in and out of the bottles, as well as moisture, so that there's an equilibrium between moisture content inside the bottles and outside the bottles. But they were buried upside down so that the bottles wouldn't actually fill up with water and then retain that water and then flood the seeds and kill the seeds that way.
Smart.
So this was specifically designed to address that question of viability within the seed bank, within the soil.
Is there anything that we can say definitively at this point about why one seed is still viable and maybe another one becomes inert?
A lot of that has to do with the nature of the seeds and the species. But if you look at seeds, some seeds we refer to as being recalcitrant, and they're seeds that just do not have a long viability. And then there's a whole range of viability issues between different species. And it seems to have something to do with seed size and seed volume. These very small seeds seem to really retain viability for a longer period of time. It may have to do with the storage products, the genetics of the metabolism. These seeds are very slow at metabolizing. You think about a seed, the seed contains everything that embryo plant inside there needs to survive during dormancy, and then also enough to sit there and give it the energy to germinate and put up those first cotyledons above ground in order for it to fix sunlight and photosynthesize and supply that young plant with food. So when you have a really tiny seed, you don't have a lot of energy inside of it. So the metabolism slows down incredibly in those seeds, or it's slow to begin with, and until it's actually exposed to favorable growing conditions. But that's not inherent in every species. So each species has its own timer clock, if you will, internally in terms of how long it'll remain viable. And I'm not that familiar with current research on that area to really appropriately answer the question of what specifics do we know at this time. Hence my reason for diversifying the team to
right.
actually answer these questions.
Frank, you mentioned that there's at least some talk of Beal 2.0. How long do you think you can keep this going?
Well, the currently designed experiment by Professor Beal, there's four more bottles in the ground, and we open up every 20 years, so it's going to go to 2100. So that's when we'll have the last bottle, unless somebody in the future decides to kind of, you know, extend it beyond that. The problem with extending it beyond 20 years is that we don't want it to go intergenerational and actually maybe have somebody forget about the bottles. And so it's a human memory issue as well as a functional issue for the seeds. So that's a question we're going to, you know, obviously it's going to go beyond me because we've excavated the bottle just a couple of weeks ago. But the experiment that we're currently working on and looking at designing, we haven't set a time frame for how far it would go into the future, but that's going to be part of our design. And it's also going to be determined on the availability of seeds and how many seeds we put in a bottle.
I guess we take for granted that everyone involved in the scientific method, to some extent, stands on the shoulders of the people who came before them and uses the information that somebody else, maybe even before our birth, came up with. But it's not very common for scientists to take part in something like this with such a long arc. Do you think that there are things that are possible on this scale that don't happen with most of the experiments that you're involved with?
Well, I think when you look at long-lived organisms, that certainly could be the case. And when you look at evolutionary questions, that's certainly the case. We have a colleague here at MSU, Rich Lenski, and Rich has talked about his experiment. He's got about 33 years, I think, on it now, looking at bacterial populations over time and evolution within bacterial populations. I forgot how many thousands of generations he's had in that period of time. But, you know, that's a really neat way to study evolution and look at it. Of course, bacteria populations go very, very quickly. So you can have multiple populations within a relatively short period of time, unlike plants. Trees, you know, when you think about trees, are very long-lived organisms. And so tree breeders, you know, that's a very interesting question, because when you're a tree breeder, you know, how many generations can you actually produce and test within your lifespan? So there are questions out there, I think, that you know, merit, you know, looking at in a long perspective. And I think that was one of the things that was kind of unique, you know, not exclusively unique to Professor Beal, but he was one of those people who we would call a visionary. He actually planted trees with the intent of having his tree studies go well beyond his lifetime. There's a very interesting study up at Grayling, Michigan, and one here on campus that I've had graduate students and myself work on over 100 years after Beal established it, to document survivorship and growth and development of the trees over a course of 100 years. And just like his tree work, you know, the Beal seed study is one that he designed to carry on long after his mortal reign on the earth and for it to pass along. And it's really fascinating. It's just really an honorable thing to be involved with this. It's not a study that I've initiated, but yet it's a study that, you know, I have stewardship over, and that the team members that we've selected will have stewardship over in the future.
Frank Tolusky is professor of plant biology at Michigan State University. Frank, thank you so much for telling us about the Beal experiment. We appreciate it.
You're very welcome, and thank you for asking questions.
And that's Stateside for today. Our show is produced by Aaron Allen, Mike Blank, April Van Buren, and by our director, Mercedes Mejia, with additional help from Catherine Newhan, Nell Ovett, and Olive Scott. Our executive producer is Laura Weber Davis. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcast service of the University of Michigan. I'm April Baer, and we do thank you for listening. See you tomorrow.